finish yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
Aidan Rooney may well have been told that this is the final kick. Players are already congratulating one another. Rooney kicks. That's gone wide, and it's all over, and Leitrim are the Connacht champions. And John O'Mahony has done it. He did it with his native Mayo, and now he's done it with Leitrim. Just the second time the county has ever won the provincial title. 67 years ago, they last did it. My goodness, what scenes of jubilation we're seeing here.
Fantastic scenes, Conan, you'd have to say, at the full-time whistle. Leitrim, Connacht champions for the first time since 1927. Their captain, Declan D'Arcy, who's coming up on the show, being carried off on people's shoulders, proper old-school stuff. And talk about winning a Connacht championship the hard way. Roscommon, Galway after a replay, and then Mayo to win it. Incredible stuff.
Yeah, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it right. It's unbelievable watching that. Like, that does make you pine for the days when, like, the provincial championships mean that much.
Yeah.
Like, you can tell that is football. Like, and like, there's 18,000 people in Hyde Park, and I'd say at least two-thirds of them were from Leitrim. And this is Mayo we're talking about. Like, you know, it's not like a watery support. So it was unbelievable. And I'd say they probably almost expected it, like, going into that game. Like, or had a bit of expectation anyway, having beaten, as you say, Roscommon and Galway, both of them away after a replay with Galway. But it was class to watch.
Absolutely class, because we know how crazy the Leitrim fans are. Like, I mean, you were in Croke Park for that Division 4 league final, and they were coming home from America and all sorts of places for a Division 4 league final.
Yeah, like, I genuinely, there was a stage where myself and my brother were thinking, are we the only Derry fans here? Like, you know, it was green and yellow all around. And, like, that was, like, their 25th anniversary. They hadn't been to Croke Park since 1994, so they were all going up. And I remember Sir Paddy McKenna, who we both work with, he's from Leitrim, and he showed me his Snapchat mat. And, like, you can see sort of where all your friends are. It's pretty creepy, but you can see their location, and like all of them were on the road up to Croke Park. It was amazing to see it. And like, yeah, it's like, it does, it just means more to them. Obviously they hadn't won anything since 1927, and
but this was kind of coming. They won an under 21 Connacht title in 91, then John O'Mahony took them over in 93, and they beat Galway and Tuam, which was a huge result. And funnily enough, they were very confident coming into this Connacht Championship. I was reading that at a pre-championship weekend in Castleblaney, the Leitrim players pooled their money into a pot, went down to the local bookies and put a wage on winning the 94 Connacht title at odds of 16-1. So we don't know how much money to put into that pot, but it was a fairly good bet. Funnily enough, we did that with Leash in 2003, or the Leash County Board did. We were at 16-1 to win Leinster that year, and we actually, that bet came in. And we did it with Portlaoise in 2004. We hadn't won a county title in 2 years, and we were 16-1 to win the Leinster Club. And we went on to win the Leinster Club. I wonder how common this is.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Like, because I didn't really hear of it before championships. Like, I'd hear one off games, obviously Donegal in 2014. I remember a boy in our team, Scarys, had a bet on to beat whoever, and like, we were losing heavily at half time, so he was probably shitting himself. But I don't know how often it happens, like, you know, before a championship, that you go and put a bet on that early. Like, you must be well prepared going into it.
I wonder, is there a psychology there that you're putting a bit of pressure on yourselves? Maybe not pressure, but just, we're that confident, you know, we're going to go to these steps. I don't know. Like, I'm sure this happens and it doesn't come off. There are definitely three examples where it did come off. I wouldn't mind the start Leitrim made straight from the throw-in. Absolutely dreadful mistake by Seamus Quinn, who won an All-Star that year. He was only his second year. Dreadful mistake by him, and dreadful mistake by the goalkeeper for not commanding his square and telling him to stay down and get out of his way or whatever. So goal down immediately.
Yeah, and like, just no need to do it either. It wasn't like Liam McHale was in there on top of him or anything. There was two of them there who could have just caught it at their canter, and they just panicked. Like, it did seem like the first 3 or 4 minutes that Mayo were definitely the most confident. Obviously they'd won the Connacht twice, I think, going into that. 94 season. And yeah, they were on top. They won the throw in. They put it in early, got the goal. Leitrim kicked three awful balls away straight away. Like the first 7 minutes are terrible. Five times the ball goes out over the end line. Like in the first 7 minutes, just kicked too long. And Leitrim were the biggest victor, the biggest culprits of that. But terrible start, but should have got back into it.
Yeah, no, they definitely did. We'll talk about the match now. We'll talk about the match in part two. I was reading as well, John O'Matney obviously was the manager, and he was well known for planning and organisation. And he had a fella called Brendan Harvey, who was a Leitrim man, and he lived in Dublin. And he acted as O'Mahony's scout. So he'd never go to Leitrim games because he'd be off watching the opposition. And he used to ring county boards, and he'd ask them, opposition county boards, and he'd ask them for the video of the match. And, you know, he'd say it's for a relative over in Australia, a sick relative. And he used to be able to source these videos of Leitrim's opposition that year. So, like, I mean, John O'Matney definitely ahead of the time when it comes. Like, this is Jimmy McGuinness-esque sending someone down up a tree to spy on Kerry.
You know, like, there's so, like, obviously that's class and going to extreme lengths to do it. But there's something nice about that as well, because I think nowadays a lot of managers become obsessed with the other team. Whereas if you have another person designated to go do it, then they can look after that and they can come back and tell you everything you need to know, and you can still focus on your team. And like, you know, like what's the point of having all this information on the other team if you're not going to use it to sort of, you know, plan how your team are going to expose their weaknesses? So it's nice that a manager like John O'Mahony can still focus on Leitrim, and somebody else can give him all the top line points, even if he's sitting in a tree or whatever he's doing to get these pieces of information.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And then there was great scenes at the full-time whistle. Declan Darcy, he lifted the cup along with the 1927 captain, Tom Gannon, who was a very old man at that stage. So that was lovely scenes. Were they presented with the cup out in the middle, out in the field as well? It didn't seem to be up in the stand, I thought. Did you notice that at the end?
Yeah, it was a bit more of a weird setup. But I remember the picture of Tom Gannon and Declan Darcy. It looked to be a bit more of a stand setup, but I'm not too sure. He was 95 at the time.
95. So that was a lovely cut.
Yeah, and like, sure, obviously there's an unbelievable photo now, like the only two Leitrim captains to win the Connacht title. So yeah, lovely touch, and it's just a moment sort of captured in time. And like that is important. You're talking about putting bets on. Like, this Leitrim team, probably this might have been a bit of a golden generation for them, and there does come a time for every team. You've probably known it yourself. Like, where you have to win now, you're never going to win. And like, this was probably it for them, like, that around that period. And if they didn't win a Connacht title, they might all be looking back now, 25 years later, thinking, how do we let that one go and just be nearly, man? But they did it.
Well, that's it. The following year, they were beaten by Galway by a point, and then they went off the radar completely. Funny enough, Declan Darcy was lucky to be even on the podium lifting the cup, because he took an awful kick to the balls by the Mayo number 7. Did you see that karate kick straight into the ball? Just a routine name taken. That's all it was taken as. He just jogged off back down the field.
The referee was unbelievable. Did you see Mickey Quinn got a tick for the tackle on Kevin Cahill? He just came across and boxed him straight in the face. And John Conley, he didn't even get a tick for his shoulder straight into the face of your man Reynolds, the cornerback for Leitrim. It was different times, all right.
He seemed to have it in for Liam McHale then as well, because he got a yellow card for practically nothing, for just putting his hand around. I think he'd sent Liam McHale off the year before. But he gave Liam McHale a yellow card for practically nothing. But we'll leave it there, Conlon, because Declan Darcy actually joins us on the line now. Declan, we're talking about the kick and the balls you took in the second half. There were definitely tougher days back then.
Well, normally in them days, you might get a bounce to the head or to the back of the head, but that was a peculiar tackle technique by any stretch of the imagination. And I certainly, but look, that was part of playing football in them days. You had to take the rough with the tumble, but I still even think it back and it makes me squeamish, all right.
Like, I mean, I think he got a yellow card, but there was no real outrage about it in the commentary. I think it was just, look, that's after happening. He got booked and then he jogs.
I think there was more grief given to me for lying down than there was for the fact itself. So that was you know, I took way too long to stay down, but it was very near the end of the game. But God, yeah, it was when you look back on it, it was the second Irish tackle, all right. But
I was looking back on the game yesterday. Like, I mean, the conditions were terrible, and it was a very scrappy first half, I thought. But then And at the end of the first half, you started to kick a little bit and you were by far the better team then in the second half. Is that fair analysis of it?
Yeah, I think that, I suppose, the goal went in the first 60 seconds. So, and in some ways, it was a good thing to happen to us because it startled our thought process and gave us a very narrow focus to start playing football very quickly, because the occasion obviously was a massive occasion for Leitrim. So that kind of got rid of that kind of initial thought process and got everybody to focus on what was needed to be done, and that was to play football. And we started to grind away and get ourselves back into the game. I do think that considering the other games that we played previous made us very formidable, and even mentally in our heads we knew we were well capable, but we were the much better team than Mayo, and it was just a question of could we focus on playing football. And I think that goal gave us that opportunity to narrow our focus and continue to play good football for the rest of the game. But it's funny how that Mayo never scored after that in the first half.
Yeah.
That goal. So it did give you an indication of how dominant we were in the game. But again, that occasion was massive, and that's not to be underestimated when weaker teams are trying to achieve something that they've never achieved before. It kind of has a mental weight as well. So there was a lot for players to handle on that day.
Yeah, like you were very confident going into it. We were talking there, you obviously beat Roscommon and Galway, an incredibly tough run to win a Connacht title. But I was reading that players went pooled money into a pot and backed yourselves at 16-1 to win the Connacht title. Is that true?
I think that's, there was a certain move to a bookies, but I don't think we were that confident. But we definitely think that 16-1, we were well, because the previous seasons, don't forget that we were kind of close enough. We felt that we were unfortunate to lose games. We beat Galway previous year in June, which was never done before in Leitrim team. So we had chipped away at things and we felt that we were kind of thereabouts. So yeah, but I don't know. Nice bet, though, in fairness.
The reason I was laughing at that is because when Mick O'Dwyer took over Laois in 2003, Laois were 16-1 to win the Leinster title, and the county board put $3,000 on it to win $48,000 when we won it. I was just laughing when I was thinking that maybe you did the same thing.
No, it was a kind of more bit of crack, I think, than anything else. And it did but at the same time, you know, any little thing like that does give players a little bit of traction and stuff, but more novelty than anything else. But it was nice at the end, in fairness, little rewards for everybody and the rest of the
team. I'd say now our $48,000 ended up down in Kerry rather than anywhere else in Laois, but we won't say too much about that.
No, you can say that.
Well, come here, even on the confidence thing, Declan. John O'Mahony had booked an open top bus before the game, so you won the match. You went back and you got on an open top bus, so he was fairly confident.
Well, there was no, like, John would be very diligent in his preparation, as everybody would know, and I think we had an insight, and not that I think John wanted to shelter us away from that, but the insight into the Mayo camp wasn't as good as would normally be, and we knew they were fairly fragile. So I suppose from John's context, he was covering, as he does and did, cover every angle to make sure that we got what we required. An open top bus, probably a little bit extravagant, but at the same time, and we do remember Mayo organising a homecoming in Castlebar that kind of came back to bite them. But thankfully, John was so diligent that he tried to hide an open top bus in Carrick and Shannon, which I think was an article in itself. But we didn't see the pre-game, so we were okay, but we were delighted to see it when we came back to Carrick.
There was some fantastic scenes at the final whistle where you're all being carried off. That was par for the course back then, where you'd be carried off on people's shoulders, you know. Like, I mean, then the cup presentation, you lifted the cup with Tom Gannon, who was the captain in 1927, and basically Leitrim fans going mad. We know they're passionate. We heard the noise even in a Division 4 final, was it last year? So, like, I mean, I'm sure it was a crazy, crazy time.
It was a crazy time, but I think the one thing that team did, it bonded, it had a very huge, it had a big connection with its supporters and its county. And Leitrim people are very passionate about their football. But it gave them a voice. And, like, there's no kind of denying it, but Leitrim people probably were put down a little bit in certain regards, not maybe thought highly of in many ways, but this team gave them a voice. And there was people that kind of could stand proud for that day, and including the day in Croke Park as well, and just be very proud of what they were about and who they are. And I think that team was given an awful lot of people right throughout the world as we witnessed their day. And it was something very, very special. It was much more than a game of football, as I kind of found out afterwards, and even to this day, a lot of people coming up to me. It was much more than just a game of football, but it was a magnificent occasion. It's just one of those things that you're just fortunate to be part of and to experience, because that raw, honest passion and delight and joy is something that the GAA, just once in a while, once every now and again, gets a little insight into what it means to people. And Laois did it, Westmeath, you know, you had Wexford, Limerick, you had, you know, Clare, you had a vast variety of counties that have experienced it. And when it does happen, it's priceless. It's really priceless.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. Do you think it's kind of missing a little bit now when teams win big matches, the pitch invasions, I suppose, especially in Croke Park? I know it's good for players to do a lap of honour, but the whole pitch invasion and being carried off it, you know, maybe I'm just a traditionalist, that there's something I miss about that.
Well, I think it probably is a struggle for us, because we have such a big connection to our community and our families, and it's intertwined into our games, into our teams. And I suppose when that moment happens, people want to be really close and attached to the players. It's probably something that doesn't really kind of resonate with a lot of other sports, but it's very, very close to GAA people and that passion. And you can see it even at underage games, just people are going nuts, like they wouldn't normally go nuts, because it's just our game, it's our community. And what it is, it's very hard to not like to see that happening. But obviously from the health and safety point of view, there's obviously huge issues as well. So, but it is a miss, I think, when players and the more yourself, they've experienced that overwhelming joy, and it's engulfed by supporters and family. It's just a lifetime memory. And I suppose for teams that do win now, probably they miss that connection. They're separated a little bit from the people that matter to them. And it's, even in Croke Park, you have stewards there obviously trying to do their job, but they're kind of still very kind of staunching towards letting families in or your kids in.
Yeah.
It's difficult, and there's a little bit of a disconnect there, and it's a bit of a miss, all right. You might get it in a Junior B championship final, all right, win, but I don't think you're going to get in Croke Park.
Yeah. Come here, a couple of years later, then you transferred to Dublin, because you are a Dub. You grew up in Dublin, and then you moved to Leitrim. Like, I mean, that must have been a nightmare for, it doesn't get any more cushy than going to Leitrim, Declan. So there's nothing a Dub would hate more than becoming a cushy.
Well, look, I had no kind of real agenda. I'm from Sandy Mountain. It's a beautiful little village in Dublin. And I started playing my football. Great teachers, Terry Leddy and Aidan Sweeney, in Stanley C School, who gave me great kind of foresight into football, and in Dublin 4, which is traditionally kind of rugby territory. So it was funny, because I'm stuck in Dublin 4. I'm playing for Clannagale. I'm going to New Park Comprehensive School, which is a Presbyterian dominant school. And then I leave New Park, Black Rock, on a Friday on a bus, and I go into O'Connell Street, and then I'm whisked off down to Leitrim for the weekend to play GA. It was mad. It was just pure, like, when you think of it, the guys, my friends in New Park, just couldn't get their heads around what I was doing. They didn't even know where Leitrim was. They couldn't fathom why I would do this. So it was a bizarre experience for me. But the big thing for me, obviously, going to Leitrim was how people down this, particularly all with them. And it's one of the big strengths that the GAA has, is that welcoming piece. And they did welcome me with open arms. And it was just fantastic. And it's a great memory again for me to have, is that warmth of welcome that the people of Leitrim gave to me when the time I was there.
Right. So I thought you moved to Leitrim. You were going back on a bus to play.
Well, I started making when I was 16. So I was still in secondary school. So I'd leave New Park
around 3 o'clock, head into O'Connell Street, and we'd be picked up on O'Connell Street and brought down, play a match that evening, play another match on the Saturday. And then, believe it or not, in the day, you might remember this, but I was able to play a junior and a senior match one after another on the Sunday and then come back to Dublin. So
they were making the most out of it, yeah.
They were getting their pay there, but recovering session is right the thing at the day. But obviously, a lot of football. But great, Jesus, great memories, great times. But that was it really for me. I always travelled. I would stay in people's houses.
Did you want to play for Leitrim above Dublin then, or was it your parents making you do that?
Well, to be honest with you, and even probably to this day, I didn't rate myself as a really good footballer. And at that time, I was very small and I wasn't making any impact. And I had no real mad desire. I loved football, but I wasn't kind of going around saying I wanted to play in inter-county teams. Just really at that time, I wanted to play with Aoife Willin. Aoife Willin were a very strong club team. Did Mickey Quinn, Frank Smith, there were some very special players. And I just wanted to be part of that. And no more than that. But then at 17, I got very big very quickly. And I was actually training. I used to train in the mornings with the Irish swimmers. They'd be coming in after pool because New Park was where all the Irish swimmers used to train. And I'd come in at the back of their swim sessions and I joined their gym sessions at 7 o'clock in the morning and joined their gym sessions. And then within that year, I kind of started to physically get bigger. And then all of a sudden, it began to dawn on people that I actually could make an impact. And then my inter-county career took off at 18. But I had no agenda. I never thought that I was any good to play for Dublin or any county team when I was a young fella. So it just started to spiral. And then all of a sudden it kicked for me. And then obviously the story kind of went on and went on.
I did notice in that Connacht final, you in particular, it was catch and kick football back then, and that was the style. There's nothing wrong with that. That was the way it was played. But you very rarely just launched it. You were always looking for that kind of inside of the boot pass, maybe to a wing forward or something. Was that something in your mind that you didn't want to just be driving it and giving it away?
Well, don't forget, a lot of my football was probably played as a forward, so it was kind of a forward player instead of half back. I kind of slag Jack McCaffrey, or I'm similar to him. I actually don't mark anybody. So I kind of just played my own game. And it kind of caught people a little bit of a hop because it was different. And they were very traditional to have a centre-half back that was prepared to make runs up the field and to play football. It was kind of alien. There were more in my day. It was kind of like John Mahan type, who was physically imposing and kind of dominant in his position, and then that wasn't kind of seen as a playmaker to a degree, but I was kind of different, and again it gave us a different dynamic, and it gave me a position of a little bit of freedom to not be man-marked as well, and it allowed me then to function. I had a great relationship with Pat Donoghue, who was a midfielder, and he would always, well, sometimes anyway, at least try and cover for me if I did. There was a kind of a thing that if I went or made a run up to the forest, that he would cover my position. So in some ways, it functioned very well for us. And then obviously, I enjoyed playing that role. I thought it was a fantastic position to play.
Yeah, Kamir, I want to ask you about Dublin, because I'm said to you that you're a bit like Kaiser Soze with Dublin. People know you're involved, but we never really see you or we never really hear from you. So, I think that was the way you liked it when you were with Dublin. Do you miss it? Have you got a load of free time on your hands?
I think one thing that kind of caught me a little bit, I played inter-county football for 14 years and involved for between under-21s and senior 11, 12 years. So that's 26. That's half my lifetime nearly involved at inter-county football. So it was like a second, same thing as when I retired from football, the feeling of, not having that structure, not having that routine. Very difficult, and some people I underestimated with coaches and management staff that aren't involved with teams the following year. And I'm only speaking on behalf of them, maybe, that people could a little bit understand that they'd probably tip up. And I'm involved with Clannagale Fontenoy, which I'm delighted to be. But there's a vacuum there, and it's hard to quantify the feeling of not being involved, and particularly with this group of players. There were an unbelievable group of players, and there's a massive bond. within the group, and a loyalty to each other. And that I miss greatly, because even though I still keep in contact with the lads, but not being around them and not being part of their footballing careers now is quite difficult to handle in some respects. So, you know, Johnny Cooper, for example, I would have, when I started, I was kind of underage in Dublin coaching, and I would have seen Johnny at 15. So I've actually seen his journey from 15 to his 30s now. So that's massive. And a lot of other Rory or Carl, I would have seen a lot of those players evolve, you know, from youth to under 20s to right through their adult football, which is a phenomenal journey to be part of. But, and it's something that I kind of miss, but that's just part of life, you know.
Yeah, it's actually just that you mentioned Johnny Cooper. There's a good picture of you with your arm around Johnny Cooper. I think it was when the five in a row was achieved, and obviously he had the sending off the first day. I didn't picture that kind of journey he would have been on since he was 15.
I think that picture tells an awful lot more than actually, you know, people look at the picture and see. But there's a huge background to that. And obviously that long journey that, you know, Johnny had, you know, the slight rejection maybe with under Pat Gilroy's, because he was captain of the under 21 team. He was destined to be, you know, a star, and that journey was stopped in its tracks. For him to reboot himself and get himself back into the team was massive. And but then that micro piece from the first day, Mark and David Clifford, and just having that little, the preparation pre first game, kind of giving them, putting them on a little bit of an edge, that gave them his decision process a little bit, not where it probably should have been, and what unlike him, to be fair, in regards to his first game. But then having the time to reflect and then to adjust and then to put in the performance he did in the second game was just like massively rewarding for him personally, for us as coaches, but also for the team as well. So that was a huge moment, and there was just a little caption there that I think someone caught, and it was just perfectly illustrates the care of a coach to a player, and that emotion probably back is kind of, it really reflects that very well.
Yeah, one thing I always said about your management team is that when you drew with Mayo or you drew with Kerry, you were very good to correct the things in the week after the match. Do you know, like, I mean, like, there's no, every management team gets things wrong, you know, in Drongis, but you were never shy about correcting them, and you generally got the calls bang on for the replays.
And sometimes you get things right and sometimes you get things wrong, but obviously if we got time to analyse and operate correctly in the way we functioned very efficiently. So if we got time to review or get something right or to adjust, we could do that very quickly. We had the players to do it. And the really good thing, what we chased was not the winning or losing of a game. We chased our standards. So we would have our own standards of football where we wanted to do it. And it's a great way to look at football, because it takes away the emotion of whether you lose, you play, or you win. Because sometimes you can equally learn as much in winning as you do in losing or drawing. And some people miss that bit. So we always went after our standards. So that's where we would review the game with the players individually and collectively as to what that standard, what did we set out to do, achieve? Did we do it? And we really stripped back whether there was a winning or a losing element to it or drawing. It was just, how did we function? And how can we, if that presents itself again the next day, and how would we function better? And it was all about learning and improving. And the guys had that game intelligence in their locker to be able to see things and accept them, and then obviously to evolve. But you have to have players in that bubble to understand that and to evolve and to get better from them situations. And I think that's one great credit to this, that Dublin team, is that they had that ability within them. Their game intelligence, they're all very intelligent guys, and they can just deal with stuff during game and pre-game, after game, very, very well.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good way to do it, because, like, I mean, traditionally, if you score a last second goal to win the game, the performance is seen as good, you know, because you won, rather than how is the performance without, you know, winning, drawing or losing.
Well, winning, losing or drawing, they're just emotions. To be honest with you, being really clinical about it, so your application to what you're chasing is obviously performance. And can you perform to a level that at your standards? So obviously, each team has different standards of performance that they can achieve. But if they don't get to 8, 9, 10 out of 10 in their performance, they're not going to give themselves possibly a chance to win the game. So instead of chasing the win, you're better off chasing the performance. And what does that look like? And that's the key piece. And it takes away the emotion, particularly pre, during game and after game, for players, how they think about football. Because if you get caught up pre-game, the game is here with so much at stake here, so much to win, as opposed to the players, they're thinking about how they're going to function and how they're going to play. That's their concern. And even during game, you know, that's why this team, you know, when there's 2 minutes on the clock, there could be 3 points down, and all they're focusing on is the next play. They're not one bit worried whether they're going to win the game or lose the game. They just want to play the next play as best they can. And they understand if they do that, they give themselves a huge chance to function really, really well. And that's the bit that we were chasing.
Is this where this famous process word that Jim used came out of? I think I'm starting to understand where
Jim was obviously, you guys have loved Jim, but he wasn't a million miles off it, to be honest. And everybody was kind of thinking, he's only pulling that out of the hat there. And he's kind of just saying that. But a lot of it was. And, you know, when you think about it, you know, the players are in that bubble and they were functioning really, really well. And the exceptional bit about them was, you know, in the white heat championship football, well, a lot was at stake. And at any stage, you know, you're talking about two in a row, three in a row, then it was, and then the final. There was a lot of chips on the table. And a lot of pressure when it came to certain games, as you've seen. And were they able and capable of functioning correctly? And I think a lot has to do with that process piece and what it looked like to them. But don't forget, you know, it might work for this particular group of players, which it did really, really well. It mightn't work for every group of players, but it certainly gave us huge traction and actually being able to perform at the really, really key moments of the games. Guys didn't lose focus of what they had to do, and it was a brilliant, brilliant piece. And then to see them executing it, particularly in the All-Ireland final last year, the drawing game, when it was a lot at stake and things not going their way, they still had the mindset to function really, really well.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. That was an incredible last maybe 7 or 8 minutes of that game where they were just hunting Kerry down with a man down. There's no doubt about that. Come here, talking about Jim Gavin, his decision to step down, did that come as a surprise? I don't think he planned to leave it so late in the year to step down. So you know, maybe something happened with him. Did it take you by surprise? Were you planning for 2020?
No, I've been with Jim since the very start, and 2003 when Tommy Lyons gave us a bit of a head, and I kind of know him really, really well, and he's put in a massive, massive shift for Dublin. Completely, I think people they kind of just don't realise the work he has put in. It's been phenomenal. I've seen him in operation, and it's just his drive, his determination, his resilience. He's put in a phenomenal, and that in itself takes a toll. He's a young family, similar to myself, and went to the Kerry National League game, and was the first time I was able to bring my kids to a Dublin match. You know, and that's when you take stock of, my God, this how much this takes out of your life.
Yeah.
So I think there's huge parts to that that people don't realise when they look in and they see Jim and they see him functioning, and then they kind of go, why did he step down? But there's a whole lot of stuff. He's a pretty important job as well, and it kind of, there's a lot of things that we would have noticed in Axel Foley down in Munster. And you know, sometimes sport can overwhelm you with effort and work, and you know, there is a life to live outside of football, as we are witnessing at the moment particularly, and sometimes you just need to take a breath. And I think, just for Jim's sake, I'd say even from the health and personal reasons and everything else, it was a time for him to just take a deep breath. And in fairness, I don't think anybody could complain in any way. If there was anything that was delaying him, I would think it was more the connection he had with the players.
Right.
Than anything else, and letting go was the hardest part, I think, of and completely, I suppose, for most of the management group, that was the bit that kind of caught us the most was, you know, the day that Jim announced it was, that was one of the toughest days. Now, that was hugely tough to be in that room and to experience the emotions, and from the players to us and for us to them, it was a massive day. And I think we underestimated that. But Jim is just, what a worker. Man, oh man, he puts in some shift. So there's a lot for him to balance. And I think, again, as I said, it's probably no harm just to take a breath. And he had put in a big shift, and he's left his county in a really, really strong position now.
Yeah, he's going to be a tough act to follow. There's no doubt about that. The only reason I was wondering is because he celebrated in front of the hill after the 5 in a row. Now, I know it was a 5 in a row, but it was very un-Jim Gavin. Like, and you celebrated, and so did Jo. And it looked almost like he brought his father into the presser. And I know from dealing with Jim, you know, he's not usually that relaxed after a match. You know, I was thinking that almost mentally he had gone, we've done it, I'm done.
There was two things, I think. Our rationale always would have been the players are number one. So after a game, we certainly didn't want to be seen to be jumping around Croke Park. It wasn't our day. We've had our day in the sun playing football. It's always about the players. And the management just always take a step back, particularly on game day. It's their day. It's not your day. You know what I mean? While we're a part of it, it's, players are number one. And I think Jim would always, and myself, would just always take a step back and let them to the front, because it is their day, it's their time, and they need to enjoy it and make the most of it. And they don't need a management team that's impeding on that, which we would feel very strongly. And also, I think last year particularly, was a huge connection within the team. There was a lot of stuff going on in the background. We had Philly's dad passing away, with John Small's dad was very sick. And there was a huge connection within the group, and there was a lot of emotion after the game, and there was a release of the pressure, because probably we didn't want to talk about the 5 in a row, and we didn't want to kind of dig too deep, but we all knew it was there, it was hanging over us, and it was kind of like a monumental kind of weight off our shoulders that had it gone now, because it was sitting heavy on us, no matter what anybody says. So there was a huge release there after the game, an acknowledgement too as well, of a wonderful group of players, and just for us, and we'd be very, I certainly, it's not my farm to go up to the hill, or Jim's anyway, that's for sure. But it was kind of maybe in the back of our heads that maybe that was it, the subconscious thinking we had done our time, we'd done our shift, and just to say goodbye and thanks very much, and great memories.
Yeah, definitely great memories. A great way to leave it. Declan, thanks very much for giving us your time there. I've used up enough of it. I'll let you go here. I'll talk to you again.
No problem. Thank you.
You ready? Let's go.
I've had fellas follow me. And not just Cork lads, you know what I mean? It happens. It happens. Yeah. And it does happen. Yeah. But I'll tell you one thing, it's a lonely spot, and the best thing you can do is keep moving. And I thought Connolly looked to be trying to do that the last night.
The camera showed it didn't look great, there was, maybe if they could say it was theatrical or whatever, but like the reality is that there was contact, and I wasn't trying to win a penalty, I was trying to go out and win the ball.
You know, actually, it's funny, your man Conan, what's his name on your programme, like, I was wondering, was he at the same match as me? He was kind of making out terrible, but unlucky to lose, like. Let's go!
20% skill, 15% concentrated power of will, 5% pleasure. All right, so Leitrim 12 points, Mayo 2-4. Leitrim by far the better team in this game. Obviously, we mentioned the early goal already, Conan, and it was obviously the Seamus Quinn mistake was the obvious one. I would call goalkeeper's mistake just as big. And Mickey Quinn actually completely lost Fallon. He went running to try and close down a ball that it was broken down to, and just left Fallon run completely through. So there was probably three Leitrim players that wouldn't have been too happy with that goal.
No, definitely not. And like, that ended up being Mayo's only score of the first half, you know, and I don't even know if you would count that as a Mayo person who scored it, really. Just a calamity of errors. To go in half 9-6 to warm that up, you would be raging, like, that's what's keeping Mayo in touch. And they didn't look like scoring the rest of the half. I think they hit the post twice, but, you know, one of them was a left-footed effort from McHale. Like I just thought that Leitrim dominated all over, like midfield. They were better up top, and like their defence just like completely snuffed the Mayo forward line out, and it was just that one wobble. I don't know, was it nerves or just a lack of communication or just freak luck that let that in? But that was the only time that Mayo looked like scoring, and they didn't even look like scoring.
Yeah, to be fair to Seamus Quinn, he completely redeemed himself by being outstanding in the game, and the goalkeeper McHugh made a brilliant save from Colin McManaman in the second half, and Mickey Quinn was outstanding. So all the three players that made the mistakes for that all completely redeemed themselves. Like, I mean, Mayo brought Leiden out as a third midfielder, right, for Mayo, and Honeyman followed him out. Mayo played a two-man full forward line with Liam McHale in it, who wasn't the most mobile player, and he wasn't actually fit. He was quoted, looking back on the game, said, "To be honest, I hadn't expected the start. I wasn't in good football shape. Decent shape, but not football ready. And all of a sudden, I was in at full forward." Maybe some of the squad were a little surprised by that as well. And getting a start in that position after four training sessions might have hurt morale. So I suppose when you paint that kind of a picture, Jack O'Shea, interestingly, who's the Mayo manager, wasn't the greatest idea. Too much, funnily enough, there was too much space for Liam in there. And Seamus Quinn, faster, younger, fitter, just pretty much destroyed him in that first half.
Yeah, and like smarter as well. Seamus Quinn just marked him from the front, and you know how many times the ball come in and he was 10 yards in front of him. And actually probably thought it was a bit naive of Mayo as well. You have Liam McHale in there, who's taller and stronger than Seamus Quinn, but they didn't drop anything in on top of him. They didn't put anything in behind. So no. Quinn could afford to stand 5 metres in front of him, and he just cleaned up. And it's funny, there was a stage where like Derek Canning kept talking about Quinn looking nervous and having a nightmare start.
Yeah.
He dropped the ball, and then he completely dominated the rest of the game, you know? So much so that McHale had to be pulled out to midfield in the second half.
Yeah, no, he did. He was moved out to midfield and he improved slightly. But you obviously mentioned the first 7 minutes, because I have 7 minutes down in my notes as well as dreadful stuff altogether. Leitrim actually had six wides in the first 15 minutes. Conlon had a wide, Fergal Reynolds had a wide, who was the corner back, and he wasn't even following Leiden out. I don't know what he was doing up there shooting, but let's not kind of overplay the final. It was very, very low on quality in the first half, you know, up until the very end of the first half, where Leitrim kicked two good scores from play, and then Leitrim played some better stuff in the second half. But the first half was dreadful stuff, outside of Declan Darcy looking like a Rolls-Royce player compared to a lot of the other players on the field.
Yeah, Declan Darcy was a real brain, and I thought like Noel Moore beside him as well, just had such a gorgeous right foot. So every so often he just pinged his class pass, maybe 30 metres, like a torpedo into someone's chest. He sort of wrapped his foot around it a lot, and you know, he had a nice swing of it. But there was a period, yeah, you used to said before halftime, and then maybe what, 10, 15 minutes after it, where Leitrim played some quality stuff, and it probably started with that Aidan Rooney score, like in the first half, where Paul Kieran played this amazing long ball into Conlon, and Liam Conlon like would win a lot of tough ball, but often he didn't have runners off him or whatever. But this time Aidan Rooney had looped out around and just swung one over off the top of his foot, and that sort of started a bit of a purple patch for Leitrim, I thought, and they kept it going right into the second half, when Mayo obviously tried to put down a bit of a marker to start, but it was no good because Leitrim were on it.
Yeah, Padraig Kenny, in fairness to him, had a very good score in the first half. He was one of the bright sparks, along with Darcy. He had a very good score on the run, and then he had a very good score in the second half as well, where he punted it on. I think punted a point. I think he was fouled in the first half as well after a very good run. So I suppose Declan Darcy breaking forward. One thing, and I mentioned it, Declan Darcy in the interview, he never drove ball. This was the one thing I thought was very obvious about him, in that was the football back then, where you just get it down the field. He wasn't doing that. All of the ball he got, he broke forward with it, or he gave a nice little inside of the foot pass, you know, to Padraig Kenny or to somebody who was breaking out for the ball. He looked like he was more 10 years ahead of his time.
Yeah. And was it so obvious? Like, when he had the ball, he was always looking up. Because you don't often see that back then, where a player's stopping to scan the pitch to see what's happening. And he just looked to see. And then, like, he would... it was almost like, you know, it was in slow motion. Like, and he could see these tackles coming in from the side as he scanned the pitch. And he just evade them and keep looking and then pick that pass. And, yeah, we always talk about these players who have that bit more time. Like, and he was the ideal number six, just sort of controlling things from back there.
Yeah, no, it was. Just, you'd have to say, like, I mean, Mayo were a dreadful team back then. Like, to go 40 minutes between a fluke goal and your second score, like, I mean, it's just dreadful. Dreadful stuff. Like, I mean, Jack O'Shea, like I said, was the manager. He didn't have a good time as a manager, but, like, James Horan came on the scene the following year. Noel Kennelly came on the scene the following year. Maurice Sherlin came on the scene in 96. David Brady came on the scene in 96. Kenneth Mortimer, 95. Then John Casey and Kieran McDonald came on. So, like, you're almost from their All-Ireland team in 1996. This 94 was a dreadful team, you know, when you count up... when you count up the amount of players that had to come onto it to make it a good team.
Yeah, and like that first score since the fluke at the start, you mentioned, was from a free, which was like a very soft one on Lee McHale, which I thought maybe the ref would take a bit of sympathy because he had just been treating him harshly all game. But and then, like, I don't think he scored again for another 20 minutes after that, and that was Kieran McDonald who came on, and that was the first score from play. And I actually would count that as the first score from play. I don't know if I would count the first the goal as a score from play, but did you not think it was strange then, like, you know, when you saw what they brought in the last 15 minutes, that McDonald and John Casey maybe weren't on the pitch a bit longer or from the start? Because they were,
yeah,
it brought them,
they were
different.
Very young. They were very young. Like, you're talking about these lads being about 18, 19 at that age. Like, John Casey played well. He kind of linked it up a bit. He didn't kick it away. You know, he kept it kind of ticking over and moving. Like, I mean, but they, like, and McDonald looked like he was on another level to the other players. I do take your point. Like, Christ almighty, some of the, even Kevin O'Neill was massively disappointing. He's an all-star. He was dreadful on the day.
Yeah. And he got the nice goal, which was a palm, obviously, from a rebound, but it was well taken. But yeah, like I just thought that Leitrim were so much on top when those boys came on. They were at least winning it, taking men on. They made the Leitrim boys look a bit more fallible. But until then, there was nothing like that. So I was like, how did it last so long without these boys being on?
Yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense. So you're right. It was the 2 or 3 minutes. Maybe 5 minutes before halftime where they got 3 points, and then the first 15 minutes of the second half go 7 or 8 ahead, and then made it a little bit nervous on themselves. But, like, I mean, in fairness, if you weren't so nervous about Leitrim getting over the line, you'd say they're well in control of this game.
Yeah, like they completely control the match. I think at that stage you're always going to have a nervous finish, aren't you? Right? Like, they still ended up seeing it out by 2 points in the end. But, like, the way, like, it was 1927, they hadn't been to the finals since 77. So I don't think it matters how much they were going to be in control of that game. It was going to be some sort of nerves that brought it back. Like, you know, that goal, the penalty that was given, that sort of summed it up. It's like, how can you have been on top so much defensively and just let somebody, I think it was John Casey, just roam inside completely free, you know, whereas they weren't doing anything like that or making any mistakes like that until the first second, obviously.
Yeah, and Kieran McDonald actually scored that goal. That usually in the current game, that would be, he would have been just given that goal, you know, because, like, I mean, it was just seconds after it fell from Casey's hand. So that would have been 1-2 for Kieran McDonald in about 10 minutes. Like, it'd be incredible stuff. But yeah, the penalty was a brilliant save then by McHugh. One thing McHugh really impressed me was his very last kick out. He went short, which was unheard tell of in 1994. He went short to Honeyman. And this was when Leitrim were just, it was only 2 points in it. So instead of going to midfield with a 50-50, he went short to Honeyman, and then it went up to Mickey Quinn, to Barney Breen for a free. And then that was the last kick of the game. It was missed. It was missed in the end by Rooney. But that was some serious composure by both McHugh, by Honeyman, and by Quinn, and by Barney Breen at the very end.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing, isn't it? You have to go and take it. You're not going to be handed a championship title. And, like, it was strange because McHugh had just been putting his foot through it to great effect all game. And, like, he sort of got used to seeing him jumping through the ball as he's kicking it and then just pinged his little pass. How many times was Honeyman on the ball and blocking down men? And, like, that was a tour de force from him.
Oh, stop. I have him down in my performance of the weekend. An absolute warrior is how you describe him. Don't use up any material on Honeyman, because he's he's definitely going to be mentioned. He was great. And, like, you know, a real stalwart on the Mayo team. Did you notice there was no celebration from John O'Matney at the final whistle? It was a pure Jim Gavin, just no emotion, no nothing, not even a smile.
Maybe he was ahead of his time as well, and we didn't realize it.
Maybe that's who's inspired Jim Gavin into the meticulous planning. You know, the no celebration, all about the players. I thought that was very impressive from Declan Darcy there, talking about, you know, the reason himself and Jim just didn't ever get involved after matches or get involved in celebrations, because they wouldn't ever want to take it away. They've done nothing compared to the players. It's all about the players. And for have a manager out running around and taking away from the players, they wouldn't be their style at all. And I suppose when you hear it explained like that, you know, it sounds impressive rather than giving out about it.
So it does all come back to John O'Mahony. Declan Darcy learned this off O'Mahony, then gave it to Jim Gavin.
Yeah.
And that's a new style of management.
And in a funny way, Jim Gavin took it to such levels that his underreaction overshadowed the players anyway. So Jim just went a little bit too far with it. I suppose Liam McHale did make a bit of a difference when he went out the field, you're right. And the substitutions, John Casey, Kieran MacDonald, Mayo had a better shape about them and were the better team in the last 15 minutes. But like, I mean, that's only because Leitrim had probably got a little bit worried and sat back on their lead, you know, rather than good Mayo play.
Ah, yeah, definitely did. And like, you know, Darcy, who always knew where to be, he was just dropping a little bit deeper, whereas he was cutting out balls from the right positions the last night, but he was dropping deeper because I think Kieran and Donoghue and Mickey Quinn and Porter Kenny even were starting to come a bit deeper as well. It was just, they were just trying to get all hands at the pump. But he, like, throughout most of the game, what I thought was class and didn't think I would see it in 1994 is that the three-man full forward line of Rooney, McGlynn and Conlon, they were sort of operating on a two-man full forward line and one person going out and taking turns. That's class to see that.
Yeah, Rooney was probably drifting out a little bit more than the other two.
Yeah, I think so. But I think Colin McGlynn was like almost in the Bobby Firmino role, where he was just taking ball and laying off people and coming back out. And you know, he was very, very unselfish.
Yeah, geez, he had a dreadful, dreadful wide in the second half.
He did.
I mean, at senior inter-county level, like that wasn't, you know, that was just not good enough. There's no point in saying anything else.
You're more unforgiving than I am.
Well, I think I've been pretty fair to Leitrim. Like, there's no point in talking nonsense about these matches. The first half was some horrific football in it. But again, the best football over the course of the game was played by Leitrim, and they by far deserved to win the game. Now, how good that Leitrim team were is another question. Like, how good Connacht football was at that time is another question, because they were well beaten by Dublin then in the All-Ireland semi-final.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I just, like, it's funny, like, the fact that they did do it the right way, though, it means that there's no asterisk, at least, beside their title. It's not like, you know, they beat Sligo and New York and whatever and won a Connacht title. They did beat everybody at the time. They were, you know, undisputed Connacht, the kingpins of Connacht, I suppose.
Well, I would go so far as to say it's the hardest Connacht championship ever won, because Roscommon, Mayo and Galway can't ever beat Roscommon, Mayo and Galway to win a Connacht title, right? So yeah. The only other team that can win a Connacht title like that is Sligo. I think they actually have done that. They have done that under Kevin Walsh. In more recent memories, I think they've beaten the big three. But like, to beat the big three, to only ever win two Connacht titles, to wait for 67 or whatever years from 1927 to 1994, and then to beat those three, and Galway after a replay. So four games against the big three in the province. Like, I mean, no wonder it goes down as, you know, kind of, it's a game that you always remember. Clare 92, Leitrim 94, they were the big ones. I suppose Leash and Westmeath then were two big ones in Leinster. You know, of the Minnows, Offaly would have had that in the 80s then as well in Leinster, of Minnows coming out of nowhere to win a Leinster title or a provincial title. And sadly, we'll never see that again.
No, but it's like, you know, it's a bit sad in hindsight, but last year they were actually thinking that getting to Croke Park, getting out of Division 4, that it was an omen for the Connacht Championship in 2019, because they had Roscommon first, and if they beat them, they would have to beat Mayo and then beat Galway. They thought it was all set up to happen again.
Really getting carried away. Right, listen, yeah. We'll come back and we'll talk performance of the weekend.
Is the little dink fist pass from a crowded area into that D, we were talking about where Bernard, I've talked to Bernard about, Bernard's very patient. But this little dink ball, you know the one in a crowded area where it's a fist pass, the weight is taken out, hits the ground, and it bounces into a fella's chest, and there's consternation then in around the D and in around that area. Watch for this in the semis and the final. Do you know the one I'm talking about? That little fisted ball that's just bounced in a crowded area, but it gets to the body.
You have said it three times.
It's in around it. But you're looking at me. You're looking
out
at me.
Of a crowded area, isn't it?
You're looking at me with such a confused head in you. It's like I was talking about you trying to get a point in coppers or something there in a crowded area. Yeah, watch for it.
So performance of the weekend, the first nomination I have down here is Mickey Quinn. His second point was absolutely outrageous. He had no right as a midfielder / wing forward with his back to goals from way out on the right-hand side with a man outside him, Conan. You're getting the curly finger if this goes wide. That's basically what anyone's saying. Shooting with your back to the goals from an angle you'd never score, and it went over the point, over the bar. And I suppose from his point of view, like, I mean, you're thinking Leitrim's name is on it when a point like that goes over.
He was sort of laughing as well after he scored. He was coming back out having a joke with someone. I don't know, maybe it was like you shouldn't have shot from there or whatever. But I think when you're Mickey Quinn and you're in your 17th season with Leitrim, you're probably allowed to have a shot from there. And especially when it goes over, you know, nobody's going to say anything. That was unbelievable. And I think that's probably, like, even watching it, even when you Leitrim had won it, you're watching it going, okay, this is it now. Like, the crowd were going mad at that stage. They knew it was their day. And as you said, name was on the trophy.
Yeah, he was 17 years, Jerk Hanning was saying in the commentary, 17 years playing with Leitrim. He'd only 7 wins, and 3 of them came under John O'Mahony in the previous 2 years. So he had four wins in 16 year, in 4 wins in 15 years before John O'Mahony took over. talking about soldiering for no reward, and that was back when you lose a first round and you're gone for a year, just coming back the following year, going through the whole thing again.
But sure, maybe that was easier because you got a longer winter and you got more time off.
We could be heading for a knockout championship this summer, which, I tell you one thing, after all the talk of championship structures, I'd be really, really looking forward to a straight knockout. There'd be a bit of nostalgia about it, and there'd be that dog-eat-dog threat kind of championship intensity that you can never recreate when you have a second chance.
Yeah, well, like, this is it. Like, I ended up going down a rabbit hole last night. So I watched this game, and then, like, I went to the highlights, 94 down won the All-Ireland, and I went to the highlights of Derry v Down, because Derry were All-Ireland champions in 93, and they played in the first round, but then Derry are out. But even then, like, the there's 18,000 there for that Connacht Championship. You look at the attendances for the rest of the Connacht Championship, there's loads of people there. At the Derry v Down game, loads of people, and you don't normally see that at a home Derry match. But I was like, why is that happening? Obviously, they're a good team, but it is because this is it. It's either you're going on to the next round or you're out. And it did have that bit more of a feel to it. I'm not falling in the championship restructure talk, but it would definitely be good as a one-off or even bring it in every so often.
Just as a matter of interest, is that Down Derry match on YouTube?
It's on one of the highlights. So it's like a 9-minute highlight package. It's worth it at some game.
All right, okay, because that was meant to be an absolute classic of a game altogether as well. Joe Honeyman, we have to mention him. Unbelievable man to block a ball down. He was just all over. And the decision to send him out, you know, like, I mean, I guess it worked out. But, like, I mean, if this was the current play, an opposition's half forward would be doing a bit of work and Joe Honeyman would be in standing in front of Liam McHale.
Yeah, no, but he made himself completely useful. Just like, he just a complete gnat. Like, you know, I know we talked about him before, but, like, he's almost like the Leitrim Iron Curtain, like, you know, where nothing was getting past. And he wasn't just standing in front of Liam McHale, he was able to make himself useful wherever they needed him. You know, he wasn't just sweeping where he was told to sweep. It was just like, if you need me over here, I'm going to double up over there. And as you say, the amount of blocks he got in, the amount of strong right-handed tackles he was just hitting boys with. He looks like he'd feel it the next day. Have you played against him?
Yeah, definitely would. Like, I mean, a proper hardy whore cornerback. I've come across a good few of them. Definitely at club level. Like, there was a lot of blocking down in the game in general, I thought. Like, I mean, again, it was easier block down back then because you kind of knew a good long kick was coming.
Well, yeah, you knew a long time was coming. You knew they were always going forward. Like, you know, you weren't, it wasn't like you weren't allowed to go sideways your back, but it wasn't in your thinking. You got the ball, you turned, and you tried to get it further forward. And so that made it easier to defend, I think, because, like, you didn't have boys running out on the loop or, you know, popping it off or going on decoy runs or anything like that. Boys got the ball. And, like, as you said, like, a lot, like, Dick and Thursday would pick passes, but a lot of them were telegraphing big, long balls into the forward line. And that made it easier to block out around the middle, especially, I think.
Yeah. When is the last time you've seen a block down in around the midfield or in around the half forward line? It just doesn't happen in the modern game. The only time you see a block down in a modern game is an attempted point.
Yeah, it doesn't happen because, like...
No, you don't kick it.
Yeah. I was going to say you're not allowed to kick it when you're under pressure, but yeah, a lot of people aren't allowed to kick it. You're not allowed to sort of risk giving the ball away. So if you're under any sort of pressure, you pop it off to somebody who's under a bit less pressure. But also the boys around the middle are being told to drop off, because if you're defending, then, you know, what's the point of defending around the middle when you can defend where's the most dangerous? You know, like that's what's happening, unfortunately. So it's harder to see those block downs.
Yeah, maybe it is. Declan Darcy, we've mentioned enough of him now. He's kind of playing back in the quarterback role and popping a few passes left and right. It was interesting for him to say that he knew, because he played a lot in the forwards and he knew what kind of ball that they liked, you know, which made sense. And then he kind of, you know, laughing about breaking forward and not marking anybody, just a bit like Jack McCaffrey. Like, I mean, Declan Darcy strikes me as a very, very intelligent man about Gaelic football, and I'd imagine he had a huge impact behind the scenes with that Dublin team, based off the interview I did with him. A very impressive fella.
Yeah, and like I actually think that he's a good example as well of just the difference in organisation between the two teams, because, like, yeah, the way he plays football is one of them, his position, and knowing when to go and when to hold. He sat back in front of McHale a few times and cut out the ball, but then even like from the long range freeze, he hit them, Maiden Rooney hit a closer in free. Just having that down, like, it just, it's the difference between them and Mayo. Like, Kevin O'Neill was hitting a free kick from the left hand side on the 30-metre line off the ground. You know, and it was like, what? Somebody just picked that up with the right foot and put it over. And he missed it, of course. Like, you know, and that just wouldn't have happened, I don't think.
And then did you notice John Casey won a free, and he's a right footer, and John Casey was lining up to take it, and Kevin O'Neill took it quickly ahead of John Casey.
He ran in
just to almost say, look, well, this is my job, you're not taking that. You know, that kind of way, because that was a well-kickable free for John Casey, and he fancied it.
And then what happened was somebody played a hand pass to Kevin Stanton, who was just completely bottled up then, and it was like, what is the point of that? Like, just take the shot.
They were a shambles. Mayo are a complete shambles. There's no doubt about that. But then we did list out all the players that, you know, that they were missing. Padraig Kenny probably is the last one I want to mention from Mayo. Two great points, one freeze. Just buzzed around. And in the first half, when there wasn't much quality, he was providing it, to the point where the Mayo cornerback Ruan was switched out on him to try and quieten him down.
Yeah, like, he was a real action man, wasn't he? Like, he got that big score to start when they didn't look like scoring. Mayo were on top. The only time Mayo were on top, really, and a bit at the end. And then he made the run, big burst and run, who won a free for the second score. Like, you know, so when Leitrim were down and nervous, he was the one who stood up. And yeah, himself and Mickey Quinn were just like prototype half forwards, I suppose. They won their own ball, they ran with it, they won breaking ball. Like, you know, they were just tough players who were fit and good at football.
Yeah, no, exactly. On the Mayo side, very difficult. You couldn't nominate anyone. Oh, Seamus Quinn as well was very good the whole way through. Any 50-50 ball was kicked in, he was out in front. But like you said, he played Liam McHale. Probably it was a lovely scalp for Seamus Quinn to get an unfit Liam McHale.
Yeah, either way, he still went back of his head, so it was a trophy for him.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what you want. You want that, especially, I suppose, in the O'Byrne Cup, you want an unfit superstar where you can actually tear into them. I suppose, yeah, like I said, for Mayo, no nominations whatsoever, none, zero from the team that started. Kieran McDonald, John Casey, I would say, from the two subs that came in. you know, we know, I'm not going to put John Casey anywhere near Kieran McDonald's level. Kieran McDonald, as a player who looked, he only looked about 17 or 18, like with the hair parted in the middle, he looked bizarre. You know, but he scored 2 points and scored it. Let's be honest, he scored that goal as well. And, you know, in the short period of time, it's always interesting watching a superstar start off like that and how he was able to look much better than everybody else in the limited time he had on the field.
Yeah, and you're right, probably, because I'm saying, like, oh, they should have started him. But, like, hindsight sent a lot into that as well, where I know that he went on to be one of the best players ever. You know, so if yeah. I was just watching that back then, it does look really young, and you probably would just think that was a good impact from a good sub, you know, where you wouldn't be thinking, why wouldn't you play Kieran McDonald? But you know what happened after that.
Yeah, exactly. Who am I going to give performance of the weekend? I think it has to go to Joe Honeyman, who was a terrier, tenacious defender who was out of his comfort zone out around midfield, but still managed to turn the midfield zone into a corner back zone. Like, I mean, however he did that, you know, blocking lads down like he would do in the corner, he turned an area that shouldn't have been comfortable for him into his domain, and he dominated it. And I suppose even winning that last kick out, even though he didn't really have to win it, but making himself available for it and getting it up the field for the last free, and that was the end of the game. I think Joe Honeyman deserves his performance of the weekend. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think I can top that description. Like, that's just perfect. You got him bang on for a cornerback who just wants to suck the joy out of forwards. Like, he just brought that to wherever he went. And yeah, that was midfield. That's where he brought it.
Exactly. Right. So, Joe Honeyman, congratulations. And that's all we've time for today. We'll be back on Thursday and we'll have a look at another match. We'll talk to you then. Good luck.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back to their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shit shock next Saturday evening that we put them back in their f***ing houses for 10 years.